Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today.
Hello and welcome to another History Hack. We have a treat for you today, ladies and gents, boys and girls. We have proper Great War history heavyweight royalty. In the house. It is the Lockie and Alex show. How you doing, Alex?
I'm not bad. Very excited about this. I know you are. You've got like a big silly grin on your face.
Oh yes.
Because it's not only World War One, it's Italy in World War One. It's amazing. I can't tell you, you are like the pin-up for middle-aged men who are like the fashion at the moment, isn't it? Is like to go outside the Western Front and do stuff. And because you do the Italian front, they're all like, damn! And you have a new book out, and that's why you're here. But how are you? How's Paris? It's Bastille Day.
It is Bastille Day, and everything's shut. So, yeah, Paris all good.
Wonderful. So, you've managed to offload your child, who's not today, with Daddy. So, we're going to talk about your amazing new book. So, last time you came on to talk to us about it's your thesis, isn't it, that you worked on the book, which was Morale in the Italian Army. But we're going much broader today because you have a new book, which is amazing. We've both read it, Italy and its Empire in the First World War, which is great because we hear a lot about Germany wanting an empire and, like, you know, the Blackadder joke about just a sausage outside place. We hear a lot about the British Empire and French Imperial, but I think it passes us by that Italy are another imperial power. Is that what you want to attack with this?
Yeah, definitely. People think of Italy as a country that starts building its empire under fascism in the 1930s, right? Mm. People tend to think of the Ethiopian War and that. But actually, Italy is already building an empire starting from the 1860s, 1870s. So already by the time of the First World War, it's an imperial power. It's a pretty small imperial power compared to France and Britain, but it's still there. And it's part of the picture that doesn't really get much of a look in. So I'm excited to be able to try and fill that in. And as you said, lots of people now talk about and are interested in the French and British empires in the war. So I think it's nice to be able to show that there's an Italian side to that story as well. Mm.
Let's kind of focus on Italy itself just for a second, though, because we're talking about a very young country. You know, you say the Italian Empire kind of gets going in the 1860s. Well, hang on a minute. Italy itself only exists as a country from the 1860s. So kind of how homogenous is Italy at this time?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And actually, the two things are quite closely linked together. So Italy is unified in the mid 19th century, and it becomes a kingdom in 1861, but they haven't managed to get all of the territory they want. So there's a couple of key pieces of territory in the north and the northeast, which is ultimately what they're going to be fighting for in the First World War. So there's a sense of kind of incompletion and not being quite where they want to be. But because in the 19th century, there's no way to actually go about finishing national unification, and that chance doesn't come until the First World War, acquiring an empire is kind of a substitute, right? There's this sense of not being quite where they want to be. They can't get to those northeastern territories. So why not instead expand into Africa to prove that they're a great power, basically?
There's lots of similarities with Germany in that respect then, isn't there? This sort of young upstart country. I do that analogy for kids, which is like, you have to look at all the great powers like people, and that sort of Britain and France are the mature adults, and Austria-Hungary and Russia are the doddery old men who've lost their place in the world and are irrelevant now. And sort of the teenagers and the upstarts are the likes of Italy and Germany. But what makes an Italian culturally at this point, in terms of how people see themselves, what makes you Italian, and what does being Italian mean to people this early in their sort of genesis?
Yeah, it's really hard to say, because Italy is a really divided country in a lot of ways, culturally, in terms of dialect. But still to this day, if you travel around different parts of Italy, you're going to have different types of food, different very strong local dialects. And there isn't one necessarily very clear national identity, certainly not in the first period of unification. So Italy is kind of in search of an identity internationally, but also domestically. Is it about language? Kind of, but you know, people in Sicily speak a very different kind of Italian to people up north. Is it about maybe something kind of ethnic? There's a lot of ideas about Italianness as a as an ethnicity, as something that's kind of in the blood. And that's something else that they're still really trying to figure out through this period.
That's something you'd associate with the fascist side of things, though, isn't it? It really does come earlier.
Yeah, this is one of the things I found very interesting doing the research for this book. This is linked into some quite strange ideas about eugenics and stuff that come about in the late 19th century. One of the most important criminologists, actually, is an Italian guy called Cesare Lombroso. And he has this idea, it's basically like phrenology. So studying the shapes of people's heads, studying the biological form of the body would tell us about the person. And this kind of spins off into an idea of like racial purity and racial degeneration. So this is an idea that we can already see in the late 19th century, long before this kind of fascist idea of race purity that we think of in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? And it's happening in Germany as well. I mean, I just got, I'm researching something else at the moment. And if you read Von Bernardi's World War from 1911, it's a Nazi playbook. It's all about German blood and German purity and breeding out the wheat. Yeah. And yeah, it's nuts. I think it's important.
I think this is very important. Yeah, it's very important because it's easy for us to go, oh, well, those ideas were just Nazi and fascist ideas. But actually, they're much deeper seated in European science and culture, and they're much more widespread. It's almost too easy to just say, oh, that was just
you're
Nazis.
Giving Hitler and Mussolini too much credit. I mean, they stole this shit from someone else.
But that's also why it becomes so popular, because it has these much deeper roots. These are ideas that have been floating around for a long time. They don't just come out of nowhere.
Okay, well, let's go into empire itself then, and the Italian empire and how that kind of takes form. Because I'm going to kind of compare to the British Empire, where it's a lot of business kind of interests go around first, and then kind of people move out there steadily. Is it just a steady emigration thing, or is it a conquering thing? How does the Italian Empire take form?
Well, that's a really good question. The Italian Empire, as we think of it, comparing it to the British Empire, we've got regular colonies in East Africa. Yep, it's very much that similar type of model. Business people, missionaries, things like that, slowly building up. But one of the things that's really distinctive, I would say probably unique about the Italian Empire, is that when in the late 19th, early 20th century, Italians talk about colonies, they also mean emigrants. So it could be the Italian community in Brazil or in Argentina or in the USA or even in Australia, and they would talk about those as colonies. So they don't obviously think that they're going to rule them directly. They don't imagine that they're going to get a bit of New York or something. Yeah. What they think is that by having a large number of Italians there, this diaspora community, it's going to be a way to kind of spread Italian influence in the wider world, spread Italian businesses, Italian markets. Right? They're going to create markets for Italian products. They're going to send money home. And they do. They send a lot of money home. It's quite important economically, is these remittance payments from emigrants. So when they talk about empire, they're talking partly about what we would recognize as normal style colonies, but also about this emigrant empire, we could call it, of overseas emigrants.
Oh my God, did that work though? I mean, Little Italy in New York, Chicago, I mean, there are Italian, even in London, there are Italian colonies in that sense still today everywhere, and they very much are still Italian. And it's great because it means we can eat amazing food. But it really does exist, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, Glasgow, all over France, there's loads of Italians in France through this period, Germany, Belgium, you know, so within Europe and also outside of Europe, loads of Italians in Venezuela, for example. You can see it in the football team, how many Italian footballers come from Argentina because they're like their grandma was Italian or something. So
you've got Jorginho, haven't you?
Exactly. So this idea of Italianness is something that the identity stays even after you've emigrated, and even until the second or third generation, is a really important one, because the Italian state says you're still an Italian citizen and you still have to do military service. So they aren't people who are supposed to have just left Italy and never looked back. They're supposed to be people who are still very much part of the Italian state and part of the Italian nation and still tied to the to the motherland, if you want
and
to call it
financially that. As well. Can you explain that to people? Because you have to send money home, don't you? It's not just like, oh, I'm sending my mum a few pennies from my wage packet. The Italians require you to still pay like taxes.
Well, if they can, they encourage you. But yeah, certainly, I mean, a lot of it's just coming in through family forms, but there's often family business connections. You know, if you've got a small business in Italy and your cousin or whatever has moved to Argentina, then you're going to be doing trade directly with them. It's a huge source of profit and of foreign currency as well. So like valuable foreign currencies coming into Italy. So it's a big part of the Italian balance sheet.
How much of this is wishful thinking, though? Because I can't, you sort of forgetting that these other countries might have some agency, and you know, these might be kind of young countries in and of themselves, but I shouldn't imagine the USA is going to be too thrilled about these Italians just considering themselves Italian and not American as well in some measure and having responsibilities at home, as it were.
Well, this is a really interesting question that actually changes a lot during the First World War, is that Woodrow Wilson launches his Americanization campaign, and he says we want to get rid of hyphenated Americans. So we don't want people to be Italian-American, German-American, Irish-American. We just want them to be American. And there's a very concerted attack on that idea that emigrants would maintain their original home identity, and there's this move towards more assimilation. But yeah, it really depends where you go. Some countries really promote a strongly assimilationist culture and others don't.
Yeah, America definitely. We've looked at it with Nikolai on the Danes as well, the fact that sort of there's Danish newspapers and like that.
Yeah.
It's a problem for the Americans. I think that it's viewed as a problem because you don't want all of these allegiances. And it's why America stays neutral for so long, isn't it?
Right. And in fact, there's a guy called Ross Wilson who's written about this a lot. You'd get street fighting between German Americans and like allied Americans, as it were, in the first years of the war, because everyone's still got their allegiance to their original country. So the war makes it a real problem for the US, yeah. So yeah, it is a bit of wishful thinking, but on the other hand, a lot of Italians, especially the more liberal ends of Italian politics, they thought this could be a good substitute to a traditional colonial empire. So instead of going out and slaughtering people and conquering new lands, this is like a peaceful empire of trade and harmonious coexistence. So it's seen as a kind of rather more idealistic way to still expand your influence overseas rather than going to Africa and slaughtering everyone.
But
they're doing that too. Yeah, great. So yeah, they're also doing that. But these two different kind of models coexist slightly uncomfortably, basically.
Okay, well, let's talk about Africa then a bit. And I guess I think immediately of Libya when I think about, you know, Italian imperial territory. How did the conquest of Libya go?
So this starts in 1911. It's the 50th anniversary of Italian unification, and they've been looking to expand into North Africa for some time. There isn't a link with it being the 50th anniversary. It's almost like a celebration of Italian maturity. Like, we've been a country for 50 years, we're going to acquire this big new colony. The first hope was for Tunisia, because there's a lot of Italians living in Tunisia. But once the French make it very clear that Tunisia is theirs, they turn their attention to Libya instead. It's part of the Ottoman Empire up until 1911. Basically, they issue a relatively random ultimatum. They just find a kind of manufactured excuse, and they invade in October 1911. The war doesn't go brilliantly, it's got to be said, and it drags on for about a year, which is not really what Italy expected. I think Italy thought it was going to be a very quick, easy war. It's not. But eventually, the Ottomans surrender and negotiate a peace treaty in October 1912. So Italy then is officially in charge of Libya, but right from the start, again, that's more on paper than in reality, because what the Italians miscalculated was that they expected that the local populations would welcome them as liberators from Turkey. So they thought that the Arabs and Berbers of North Africa would prefer to be ruled by Italy rather than by Turkey. But in fact, that's not the case at all. And there's really no reason for them to afford that. So instead, they find that they have this basically anti-colonial insurgency from pretty much day one. And just because the Ottomans go away doesn't mean that Libya is settled and pacified and easily Italian. It's still resisting, and it carries on resisting right the way through the war.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's that this is this thing that some people have got going now where they say that sort of the First World War and the Second World War, actually, it's just an entire century of war. And they mark 1911 as the beginning of it, don't they? Because of the Italians in Libya, and then drag it through to 1945. And
definitely
relevant on a world stage, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And we can definitely link it into the Balkan Wars, because it's all about the Ottoman Empire kind of beginning to lose its outlying provinces and looking weak and unstable. And it's a really interesting example of the way that the colonial and the European wars are really closely interlinked, right? So things that get destabilized in the colonies end up also helping to destabilize relationships between the European great powers.
So what did the Italian people at home think of this? Then, if there is potentially difficulty abroad, but there's territory being gained, is that a positive thing?
Libya was surprisingly popular. Actually, it's perhaps the first big media event in a way for the Italian public. That the press, pretty much across the political board, is really enthusiastic. So apart from the Socialist Party, all different shades of public opinion turn out to be strongly pro-war. So there's a Catholic strand about kind of a crusading impulse of we're going to go and convert heathens, it's kind of Islamophobia. There's a nationalist imperialist strand saying we're going to return to the glories of imperial ancient Rome, because of course Libya had been part of the Roman Empire, so it kind of going back to the glory days of the past. And it seems to really mobilize certainly all of the middle and upper classes. I don't know that ordinary working people are particularly bothered about it, but it definitely is mobilizing a very large sector of public opinion.
Can I put something completely like that isn't on the list in there, in that to what extent sort of does Italy use this trope of like this is our legacy of Rome,
done this massively before,
and this is our justification for going. I mean, because I'm just thinking of the French and their, we once went to Syria 600 years ago and we started the first crusade, so Syria should be ours. Italy have got a much stronger, if you like, justification for an empire, haven't they?
For sure. And they use it a huge amount. And they use it both as a sort of precedent, and it says that we're rightfully should be there. But the other thing is that the Italians have a kind of national insecurity complex about their military in this time period, because the Italian wars of unification in the 19th century, not particularly impressive. You know, they need the French to come and get them Rome. They need the Prussians to help them out in 1866. They have a series of basically humiliating episodes in the 19th century. So they're very anxious to prove that they can fight. And so referring back to ancient Rome is really important. We're the inheritors of the ancient Roman legions. So of course we're, you know, victorious and military. So yeah, they use it not just to refer to specific bits of territory, but to kind of invoke this idea of militaristic power.
We're back on sort of almost racial theory, aren't we? The idea of martial races and
right,
having yourself be counted as one.
Right, and the idea that in some way, at a biological level, the Italians of 1911 are the same as the Romans of 2,000 years before, which is a pretty weird one in almost every respect.
I think as well, I was very interested in your books and in your notes that you sent us for this interview. Okay, so I'm half Pakistani and I get mistaken in Italy for an Italian. Italians, let's move on to racial theory, aren't necessarily white, are they?
Right.
Is this an issue for them culturally? Do they feel it's an issue for them?
Well, yes, in this period, it's not always just about skin tone. It's about like height and physique. Like, are they kind of big, tough, manly men? Are they tall enough? That sort of thing. But yeah, it comes up a lot to do with emigration. So this links back to that question of Italians, for example, going to the US. They're often the subject of racial discrimination in America, right? They're treated as an ethnic minority and as a kind of inferior ethnic minority. And that plays out very badly back home. So yeah, there's a lot of anxieties about, are we properly white? Are we properly kind of manly and tough? Are we a bit short? Are we a bit, you know, not quite right? they come up with this theory of like the Mediterranean races or the Latin races, and they say we're not quite Aryan, but we're a separate elite white group. But there is a real concern about it. And how do you prove that you are part of the cultural European elite? Again, military victory, great power status is also part of kind of proving that you are white Europeans.
Mm.
So then taking that forward into the First World War, you know, having your Mediterranean races fighting against the Northern European barbarians is something I guess you could argue, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that does come up. I mean, we hear a lot of this in the French context of like the German culture versus the French civilization. The Italians are very into that as well. And they're into the idea that France and Italy are similar Latin peoples, Latin civilizations. These ideas in Italy, at least, are not so much an expression of kind of strength and assertiveness as of anxiety. Like they're constantly worried that this might not be quite true. There, a lot of people are worried about Southern Italians, especially who are darker skinned. Are they inferior? There's a lot of some sort of pseudoscience being written about are Southerners more susceptible to alcoholism? Are they morally degenerate? Are they more susceptible to crime? Is there like some biological reason why they're not quite as good as the rest of us? This is both a justification, but also something that they need to kind of almost prove to themselves, basically.
But all that said, and just going away from the notes for a second, the war against Austria and Germany was by no means guaranteed at the beginning of 1914.
No.
Was it? Because, you know, you're part of a triple alliance with those two countries, and you have an army chief of staff who is firmly in the, yeah, let's go and get France.
Oh, yeah.
Camp. And so, you know, it's a funny course of events that takes things that way.
I think it's a great example of contingency. It's not at all a foregone conclusion, as you say. And there are plenty of people who would have been happy to go to war against France. Don't forget that Nice is the birthplace of Garibaldi and had been Italian for centuries. It's Nizza, right? Yeah. And they eat pesto and they may have strange kind of pizza and stuff. Anyway, there's plenty of Italians who would have liked to go and fight the French and get Nice back instead, right? That doesn't work out for multiple reasons. To do with many things, but one of them is to do with the role of Britain in all of this. Italy has no coal.
Problem.
This is a big problem. And if most of your coal comes from Britain, some of it from France, but comes from allied nations, and it often comes on British ships or it comes through British controlled shipping lanes. War with France is one thing, war with Britain.
Mm.
And there is zero appetite for war with Britain because it would have been economically disastrous.
So it's when you're a big peninsula and you've got a long coastline, picking a fight with the biggest navy in the world isn't the sharpest.
Right. And, you know, okay, so potentially you could get your coal from Germany and Austria, but if they're at war, they're not going to be selling you any coal either. So, you know, it becomes quite an urgent issue. I don't think it's all about coal, but coal and the economic side is definitely a part of it.
Yeah, because then you have to factor in. I mean, I just like the perfidious Italy line from Asquith, and that is because it is about territorial gains as well, isn't it? But we talked about that a bit last time. I wanted to ask you, so we've talked about this insecurity on the part of Italians in terms of race and that. Does that translate as a better, not understanding, a better sort of opinion of people who aren't white, or are they firmly in the European white centric, everybody else is rubbish and the white man is king camp?
Yes. The reason they're so worried about it is because they think that only the white man counts, right? Yeah. So the concern that they might not be fully considered by everybody else to be in that category is that's why it's such a problem. So we see a lot of discussions of African and Arab inferiority, and this really underpins a lot of what they're doing as colonizers, the way does for most colonial powers, right? And a lot of, so again, sort of pseudoscience discussions of what the Arab is like as a person and what they can and can't do and what soldiers can be expected to do. So they're recruiting Black East African soldiers into the military. But again, they have this whole set of theories as to what they can be expected to do and what they can't be expected to do, which is very much on racial lines.
That's something I wanted to ask you that's not in the notes as well. So we see, we're very familiar with the sight of troops from Senegal and Algeria and the West Indies and that in British and French armies. But are the Italians obviously don't have a massive empire like that, but are they recruiting their colonial subjects into the army as well and using them in Europe?
So, yes, into the army. They have, from the 1880s or so onwards, they're recruiting what they call askari, which comes from the Arabic word for soldier. So it's the same kind of word as the Germans are using. And it's mostly Eritreans and Somalians. But they also take volunteers. So there's some Ethiopians serving in the Italian forces, basically almost as mercenaries. There's even volunteers from the Arabian Peninsula and Yemen and so on. And then after 1912, they're also recruiting Libyans. So they have quite a large Libyan force. And they have infantry, lots of light, irregular cavalry, gendarmes, border forces, stuff like that. So when the war breaks out, there's a big debate. Are we going to send these colonial troops to serve on the main national front against Austria in the way that Britain and France use their colonial troops? And Cadorna, the Italian chief of general staff, says, yes, absolutely. And he sets up training camps and he says, we need to teach these men about trench warfare. And he sends people down from the front to train them how to use hand grenades and wire cutters and all the rest of trench warfare training. And then the civilian government says, no, hang on a minute. And basically for racial reasons, the civilian government blocked the idea. So these troops are all trained and ready to go and to be sent against Austria. And the Prime Minister and the Minister of the Interior say, we're not happy about sending black or Arab troops into the lines against the Austrians. So they go home. That's basically that. They continue to serve, but they're used in within Africa.
Okay.
They're used as garrison troops and to try and help suppress the rebellion in Libya.
There's things in common with the British Empire, because I think, you know, the Viceroy in particular in India was not wild at all about getting brown-skinned Indian troops used to killing white-skinned Europeans, even if it is the Germans, you know, for what that might mean to India later.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this idea of there's a sort of racial bar that they don't want to cross.
Yeah, it's like, what ideas are they going to come home with? It's very prevalent in South Africa as well during the First World War. In terms of, though, Italy is one of the great powers, but what does that mean in terms of, we talked a lot about Italian anxiety. Is there status anxiety? Because they're not a Britain or a Germany. They're not one of, I mean, like we said they were like Germany in that they were a young nation at this point, but Germany has had this massive explosion in population and industry and that, and Italy hasn't had that, has it?
Well, it has, but on a smaller level. I mean, the problem with Italy is it's not like Germany or France or Britain, but it's clearly a step above, I don't know, someone like Portugal or Belgium or Spain in terms of its demographic, industrial, economic status and in terms of its kind of diplomatic weight. So it does occupy this awkward position. It's sometimes been called least of the great powers. It's also anxious about how it's perceived. Like you think, if we compare it to Austria-Hungary, it's territorially smaller and might seem weaker in some ways, but actually it's growing, it's on the up, whereas somewhere like Austria is kind of declining. So it's in this awkward position. And the idea of the First World War is to both prove to the world that it is a great power and cement that status by gaining these important bits of extra territory, which includes colonies. So they're very clear right from the start that they want colonial expansion as well. They want more colonies at the end of the war to really just demonstrate to everyone that they're on the same footing, or almost the same footing as Britain and France.
And so we're now coming back, we're moving away, I guess, from Africa, although that might be part of it, but we're talking about possibly territory in Europe, part of those unreclaimed bits of Italy from Austria in the north.
Territory in the Adriatic as well. They've got their eyes on bits of the Balkans. And again, they're going back to these historic claims. So there's all these places along the coast of Croatia today, places like Split, even the way down towards Dubrovnik, very beautiful areas, great holiday destination. That the Venetians were there in the 13, 1400s. And so now some Italians are saying, well, you know, those used to be Italian, or Italy founded this. Look at those Italian churches. Those should be Italian again. So they're using these quite spurious historical claims. They're interested in Albania. They like the idea of a protectorate there, but also in the Eastern Mediterranean. So the Libyan War, 1911-1912, as well as Libya, they also seize the Dodecanese Islands. So that's a set of islands basically just off the coast of Turkey. The most important one is Rhodes, and all of the small islands around Rhodes, obviously now are all Greek. They had been Turkish, and they are seized by Italy in 1912 as well. And that's the beginning of this kind of pivot towards Italian interest in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East.
So, okay, so these islands with a largely Greek population, they're not totally against the idea of Italian, if not ownership, but then at least administration rather than the Ottomans.
Right. I think the Greek population of the islands, most of them would rather be part of Greece. But if that's not an option, if the choice is Ottoman Empire or Italy, many of them prefer the Italian option. So whilst not adored, let's put it that way, Italy isn't sort of isn't wholly unwelcome in 1912. But as soon as the possibility comes of unity with Greece, then the population of the islands is going to want to kick the Italians out, for sure.
Brilliant. So leading on from that, what does Italy do between 1915, when it comes into the First World War, and 23 to try and earn their great power status and sort of prove to the world that they belong?
Well, it does a couple of different things. Firstly, it's pursuing its own national objectives. That's the war against Austria, those borderlands, the unredeemed lands along the borders. But it also really wants to show that it is a valid and important part of the alliance, because it wants to make sure that when it comes to negotiating a peace treaty, everyone knows that they've really contributed. So starting in 1916-17, they start to get involved in sending expeditionary forces to multiple different places. They've already got troops in Albania. They agree to start sending troops to the Macedonian front. So they're fighting in the Balkans alongside French and British, and in fact, international allied forces there. And as the war goes on, they start to participate more and more in really kind of far-flung destinations. So they send people to Murmansk and to Manchuria. They send a very small detachment, but they send troops to Palestine in 1917. They really want to kind of prove that they're fully involved, and that continues after the war. So when there's the Allied occupation of Upper Silesia, the Italians send a delegation to that as well. So they're really trying to contribute in all of the kind of global war effort. By and large, they're not sending huge numbers of people each time, but they're making it clear that they've got a presence everywhere from Palestine to Manchuria, so that when the negotiations happen at the end of the war, Italy will be able to say, we were fully part of this global war effort. And alongside that, they're trying to seize their own bits of territory. They want to expand Libya, and they're increasingly interested in grabbing a bit of southern Turkey as well.
Yeah,
I don't think it goes quite to plan, though, does it?
Yeah, no. it'd be like naive when you think about it, wouldn't it, to think that Italy wouldn't be interested in some of the carcass of the Ottoman Empire, because who wouldn't be? It's all going to be up for the taking. Everybody knows that years before the First World War.
So the Sykes-Picot Agreement, May 1916, is the French-British moment of carving up the Ottoman Empire, and they don't tell Italy about it. And the official excuse is that Italy hadn't declared war on Germany at that point, and so France and Britain couldn't fully let them into all of their secret agreements.
Yeah, there's got more to do with the fact that they've got enough of an issue agreeing with each other, never mind the third power who's going to want
exactly.
Well, right?
So eventually, so in August 1916, Italy declares war on Germany, and the Italian foreign minister, Sonnino, says, right, now how about it? What have you agreed in the Middle East? And I've actually seen the documentation in the French archives here. The French are going, can we come up with a new excuse to not tell them what's going on? And the British are like, I can't really think of anything. And they dither for a couple of months trying to find a reason to not share the text of Sykes-Picot, because they know what's going to happen. When they finally do share it, the Italians are absolutely furious, because in the Treaty of London, 1915, when Italy joins the war, it's stated very clearly that in the event of the carve-up of the Ottoman Empire, Italy will get an equal share. So Sykes-Picot is violating that treaty that France and Britain had signed just a year before. So the Italians say, right, we have to be in on this. And after much to-ing and fro-ing, they sign an agreement in 1917 called the Treaty of Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne, at which they give basically Italy equal standing in the carve-up of the Ottoman Empire alongside Britain and France. So they get a direct rule area and a sphere of influence, just like the A and B zones that Sykes-Picot has set out for France and Britain. Difference is that what France and Britain have been offered are the non-Turkish portions of the empire. Well, not offered, but claiming. What they're claiming is the non-Turkish bits, right? They're claiming Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and so on. What Italy gets is the Turkish bit. And so that's why it's going to be so much harder for the Italians to push their claim than it is for the French and the British. So in theory, Sykes-Picot is amended, and there should have been, if it had all gone to the Italian plan, there should have been an Italian version of the Middle Eastern mandates that France and Britain get hold of.
Mm.
But of course,
they're not sharing, are they, France and Britain?
They're not. They're really not. And there's a good reason why France and Britain carved up for themselves the non-Turkish bits of the empire, because it's one thing to detach all of those Arab areas, and it's another thing to try and carve up actual Turkey itself. Yeah. And the Turks are not having it, understandably.
You get a lot more notions of sovereignty at the end of the Great War, don't you?
And the Turks are very clear. They have a kind of Wilsonian idea. We're not here to be carved up. We're not, you know, we're not a suitable subject for colonization. We're not having it.
Yeah, it's one thing taking the empire that's been falling apart for years, but if you're not taking my country, it's
exactly. Exactly.
But that can then rumble into the split of the Austro-Hungarian Empire as well, can't it? It's all these different countries, right, will break you all up as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Italy do get, I mean, so Italy's, I'm flying like by the seat of my pants here from the George V book. Italy want basically all the Croatian coastline nearly down to Dubrovnik, don't they? When they come in with their demand in 1915.
Yes.
What do they get?
Well, what they get is quite a lot of what they'd asked for, right? There's sometimes this idea that Italy gets nothing at the Peace of Versailles. It's not true at all. They get Trieste, which is the most important part for them. They get most of the Istrian Peninsula, and they get some important coastal towns and ports, Zara and a couple of other places where there is a clearly Italian population as well. There are Italians living down that coast, right? But they don't get this huge swathe of the Dalmatian coastline that they had, some of them had hoped for, and they don't get the city of Fiume, which is what becomes that real flashpoint. Fiume had not been included, by the way, in the Treaty of London. They didn't ask for it in 1915. They suddenly pop up and ask for it in 1919, and that doesn't go so well.
Although, like, now I'm thinking, well, you call them perfidious Italy, but, you know, you've been a bit piece of work as well in terms of Sykes-Picot and
running
the Italians.
Absolutely. Well, one of the problems for the Italians is, in terms of the Croatian coastline, is that they'd imagined a defeated Austria-Hungary who was a defeated enemy and that they could take stuff off. But of course, that's not the case anymore. What we now have is new Yugoslavia, and Yugoslavia is like basically an allied nation. So from being a defeated enemy, they've somehow turned into a new friend who needs to be protected and looked after by Wilson and the other allies. And so instead of someone that you can just help yourself to their territories, the allies are going to say no, that's going to Yugoslavia. And so that's not great news as far as the Italians are concerned. They almost would have preferred Austria-Hungary to survive in a very, very weak condition rather than have this new Yugoslavia come along and, in their view, kind of cheat them out of the stuff that they wanted, the stuff they thought should be theirs.
Lockie, I can see your brain working.
Yeah, well, no, there's loads to say, isn't there? I kind of think your kind of conclusion in the book where you talk about, there's a really nice phrase that you used in there, tradire e fare c'è di mezzo il mare, which is, you know, in between saying something and doing something, there's the ocean practically.
Yeah.
There's,
and
kind of, it feels like Italy wanted to run before it was toddling in terms of kind of imperial strength and committing to huge war. It just didn't have the kind of depth of resource and stability and homogeneity, if I can even say that. There's yeah. lots that it was falling short on.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And one thing that's worth bearing in mind is that, you know, I say Italy does this or Italy wants that. Italy isn't a monolith. I'm talking often about the more nationalist, more imperialist, more demanding elements of Italian public and political opinion. There's plenty of people in Italy saying, hang on a minute, we should be consolidating at home, we should be spending more money on domestic issues, we shouldn't be doing this. You know, Italy has a huge socialist party, which is very anti-war. They think it's a mistake from the start, they never support it. And they consistently say, this is a mistake, we should be spending money on, you know, education and employment insurance at home. So not everyone in Italy thinks we should be off conquering the world. The problem is that there's enough of them in influential places that they're pushing policy in this direction that even many other Italians can see is, you know, is daft and it's not going to work. So there is a big gap between this very expansionist rhetoric and ambition and the reality of what Italy can do. And part of that's to do with empire. There's this paradox that to conquer an empire, you need the vast wealth that only big empires already have by this period, right? France and Britain have the wealth of their empires behind them and they can use that to expand their empires further. Italy's empire is so small and weak, it doesn't have the resources to expand its empire further.
Wasn't even self-sufficient, was it, really, in terms of your resources, possibly food, simply, you know?
Well, certainly Libya is receiving food shipments from the mainland or from other bits of the empire. They're buying in pretty much everything for Libya throughout the war. So it's an active drain on resources, yeah.
Mad.
But yeah, it's really interesting as this kind of collective illusion that they could somehow do more than now as historians. It looks kind of ridiculous in the sense that it's really easy to see why it wasn't going to work. But there's enough people at the time who seriously think it's possible. And that's one of the things that really interested me is this gap between these assumptions and the reality of what's going on underneath and what resources are available.
It's mad, isn't it? It's just like, it's interesting for me. I keep comparing them to Germany, but it is a really interesting comparison to make because it's that same desperation to be one of the big kids, isn't it? Driving.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It happens for Germany in a different way in that they've sort of chewed off random Pacific islands and things that nobody wants anymore. And it's just interesting to see how Italy went about sort of the same problem.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I think that as with Germany, it's interesting to think about these ambitions in the light of the rise of the fascist dictatorships afterwards, right?
Yeah.
Because this issue about rhetoric versus reality, what can you really do and what do you want to do? What are you claiming you could do? Those issues become very important when it comes to the dictatorships, but actually they're already there long beforehand. They have much deeper roots, right?
And is it born out of a sense of, so for Germany, it's an obvious sense of, we lost, so this isn't good and we need to change things. With Italy, is it more of a sense of we didn't get what we wanted?
Yeah, there's a strong sense of betrayal that Italy's allies cheated her out of what was rightfully hers, right? Whether it comes to the Adriatic or to Turkey and the Eastern Mediterranean, that Britain, France, and also the USA, so Woodrow Wilson becomes kind of public enemy number one, have cheated Italy out of the kind of rightful spoils of war. And, you know, you've said this before, the Italian population suffer a comparable proportion of casualties to Britain. The war effort is absolutely enormous. It's total war, just as it is in Britain or France or anywhere else. And the population expects some kind of something, right?
So it's like for Italy feeling like they've won, but they haven't, is the right drive that pushes them towards extremism and fascism.
Yeah.
Whereas in Germany, it's obviously that they lost and they got screwed, which is what pushes them down the same road. It's just interesting that one's officially a victor and it still happens.
Yeah. So this is the so-called myth of the mutilated victory, that Italy was a victorious nation, but the Allies kind of stabbed it, I guess, in the side, as opposed to the stab in the back myth. It's not the Italian domestic population so much as the Allies who've stopped it from getting its its rightful victory. But people tend to think of that just in terms of places like Fiume and the Italian-Austrian War. One of the things I want to say in my book is that's also about the imperial context, right? The Italians also feel betrayed when it comes to the Eastern Mediterranean, even when it comes to Africa. You know, the Allies in the Treaty of London in 1915 said, we will give you compensation in Africa too. And then they do a few tiny little adjustments, but it's not really what anyone was in Italy was hoping for. So there's that real sense of betrayal and alienation.
Okay. Anything else?
I really like the book.
Thank you.
I thought it was a really intelligent, almost philosophical and sociological piece of work. And I think if anyone's serious about learning about Italy in the First World War and don't pick this up, they're missing out.
Quite simply. Vanda is basically the queen of writing about Italy in World War One in English and not writing about Britain's little contribution to the Italian front. About the Italians in England.
Let's talk about another smash up on the Isonzo.
An amazing,
I wish more people in English were writing about it, because there's so much that's really interesting, and there's really just not a lot in English at the moment out there. But hopefully, graduate students will start to work on it and people will start to write about it more with time. That's my hope.
Don't do yourself out of a job.
Well, no, I mean, I'm happy to be the queen, but, yeah. I will accept, minor members.
The minions.
She would like more minions. So
Minions can apply, and I will welcome.
What are you working on next?
I might continue more thinking about the imperial side, because we don't have a book in English that covers the whole of the Italian Empire.
Yeah. Just
a small project, yeah.
Just a little side project.
Yeah, but actually, I'm doing a project with Jay Winter about the Treaty of Lausanne at the moment, which is 1923, the end of the war with Turkey. He's writing a big book about it. I'm working with him on the Italian side of that as well. So just still kind of wrapping up some of these issues about the First World War and colonialism. There's always more to be said, right?
Always. We're historians. We'll always find something else to rattle on about, won't we? It's exactly. Basically our job. This is why we didn't do maths, because we don't just want to provide an answer and move on. We just want to cling to it for years.
That's right. So, yeah, and I'm going to Milan. So there's new archives. I don't know the Milan archives. I'm going to dig around and see what's there and see what I can find.
Outstanding. Good luck packing up the child and the cat and everything else again. Vanda, thank you so much for coming on. It's been brilliant.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, as always.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.